Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Right Owl Politics. My name is Ariana Mendez, your host, coming to you from Miami, Florida. For those of you who are new to the show, I'm a Cuban-American attorney from South Florida and a conservative political analyst. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We had a lot of listener feedback on our series, Let's Get Uncomfortable, on race relations in the United States. And one of our listeners asked if he could come on the show and interview me a little bit about my experience. So without further ado, let's jump right in and let's welcome Carlos Fernandez to the show. So guys, today we're going to do something a little bit different. The host is going to become the interviewee. So this is a little bit different, but we had so much feedback after our series, Let's Get Uncomfortable, and a lot of audience members had a lot to say. So there was one particular person that I wanted to bring on because he really wanted to ask a little bit more about that series, why Right Owl Politics decided that was a good fit. So he has a bunch of questions for me, and we hope you enjoy this topsy-turvy chat we're going to do right now. So Carlos, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. First of all, I do this with abundance of love for all parties involved, but I wanted to come on your show because as a listener, I had some questions. Let's talk about your series, Let's Get Uncomfortable With It, which was a panel discussion on race relations today. And as we all know, this topic is extraordinarily important. I mean, you're talking about plenty of protesting, riots going throughout the country because of the reactions to the racial tensions that are going on at this time. And I applaud you for having this kind, for wanting to have this kind of discussion and to make it fair in some shape or form to get a more moderate stance. So with that being said, what was your intent by bringing this panel on your show?
It was all very good intentions. So I saw that the country was at a critical juncture. Obviously, the riots, the tragedy of George Floyd's death triggered a lot of emotions across the country. And I felt that maybe as is part of a generation that is very inclusive or likes to say it, I could do my part by providing my platform as a way to bring voices that necessarily would not be available to a conservative audience. This idea came up to have a panel of women with different political backgrounds and very diverse ethnic backgrounds and races and discuss issues that maybe would not be the norm in a partisan podcast, either on the left or on the right. So the idea was to have a dialogue and have both sides discuss these issues, but the end result was a lot less of a dialogue, but that's...
And how comfortable with you were you at the time discussing these issues with your fellow commentators?
So it was interesting because I invited them all to my house, really try to welcome them into my home, provide best hospitality I could offer, really try to make them feel comfortable because at the end of the day, I was trying to emphasize unity, conversation, inclusivity. And I really went out of my way, Carlos. When I say I went out of the way, I did. I mean, I baked them, you know, fresh cookies and fresh coffee and waited on them hand and foot to make sure that they felt comfortable. And but at times, some of the panelists, the rhetoric they use made me feel uncomfortable, not for the reasons I thought it was going to be, because I felt at certain times that I wasn't meant to participate in the conversation. The desire was that I should just be quiet and listen, but that was counterintuitive to what I wanted the panel to be about, which was supposed to be a dialogue between people that maybe see an issue a little bit differently, but yet agree on the most important things, which is, you know, racism is bad. We want equality for all. We want people to be treated with respect. We're all against police brutality, but in those issues that maybe are a little bit more complex, there was a lot of disagreement, and it was frustrating that I could not, we could not have a dialogue in a way that was constructive as far as not being talked down to at times as far as participating in the discussion.
You know, the funny thing that, I mean, just to put a lighter perspective on is all this, so because your listeners don't know as much, don't know you as much as I do, for you to be quiet for most of those interviews is incredibly surprising. And I think you did them for the right reasons. But at the same time, I feel like you also kept quiet because you kind of felt like you were being talked down to. Sometimes you even felt attacked. Is that why at some moments you just allowed them to continue their rhetoric in the way that you didn't perceive agreeable?
So I didn't want to come out and be a very partisan commentator on the panel. I wanted to allow them the opportunity to speak. When I did speak, though, I tried to be respectful but pointed in my questions because I wanted clarifications on some things. But me not speaking, me not basically feeling that I was comfortable enough to share my perspectives on the stuff that was being said was a little bit interesting because, after all, this is Right Owl Politics hosted by Ariana Mendez. And there seemed to be a presumption that the person that should be talking the least is the host. And I get that from a panel discussion, but obviously it's ironic considering the circumstances.
So you welcome these ladies into your home, you bake them cookies, and for the other side, let's talk about what actually was discussed in this panel discussion. One of your panelists said that America was still racist and that institutionally we haven't done really anything to fix old norms. And this was very troubling to me because, you know, I mean, I can talk about my own history, my own things, but I also know you. I mean, coming as a minority person, coming as a Hispanic woman, a very proud Hispanic woman, you're a lawyer, you're a host of your own radio show. What are your thoughts on institutional racism? And do you really think that we made no progress whatsoever?
Categorically not. I mean, the very fact that we could have that panel discussion with the diversity on that panel shows you that we are living in a very different America than the America of slavery or the 1960s America. The fact that we've had an African-American president for two terms, that would be President Barack Obama, that shows progress. The fact that we have so much inclusiveness in terms of Black actors in Hollywood and in entertainment and in it's definitely in the legal world, we have a very diverse group of people part of that world as well, shows that there has been significant progress. Is racism still an issue? Of course. There was, unfortunately, as long as humans are human, there's going to be some individual out there that's going to hold hatred towards another group of people just because of who that group of people are. Unfortunately for us, I think dismissing the reality of racism is also not a good idea because then we're dismissing an issue that's prevalent in society. But I will reject the notion that America is an inherently racist country because there has been so much progress made. And yes, there can always be more progress, but we need to acknowledge the progress that has been made.
Well, and on top of that, I just want to also bring up a few things, right? So I think it's very clear from what you just said and also knowing you that there is never an institution where you're going to say, well, we are free of racism, we are free of prejudice, we're free of all these things. In reality, I think a lot of times what the other side is asking for is unattainable. There is no such thing as the purification of ideas and the purification of oneself, right? We can only try to aspire to make our institutions less discriminatory. We can only aspire to make our way of thinking and adhere to the very words that our Constitution actually is verbatim written by, which is the idea that every man, and this now includes women, includes also minorities, have the right to pursue happiness. They have the right to be American citizens. They have the right to be protected as American citizens. So I think that as far as that goes, my viewpoint on that specific issue is that, yes, racism exists. And yes, we can always do a better job to try to make the system more rewarding and positive reinforcement to inclusivity. But at the same time, to suggest to me that we are just inherently doing things because we hate people, I just think is erroneous. So I'm also on the same boat as you are in this perspective.
If I may add, it's also sure. important to note that, you know, institutions are made up of people, right?
Yes. So,
because people are imperfect, those institutions are never going to be perfect. Can we Correct. Strive for better? Absolutely, and we should.
With Absolutely.
That said, government in these matters can only go so far. You cannot change human behavior without the person deciding, I'm going to change the behavior. So if they're, instead of saying, oh, we need to be more inclusive, what concrete steps you as a person can take to be more inclusive. That goes from if you have a minority person working with you at work and you may not speak to them as much, but maybe you invite them out to lunch one day and get to know them a little bit better on a personal level and find out you have so much in common with them. That's just a very, if you will, silly example of how you can take steps to kind of extend a hand, a friendship to somebody that maybe you wouldn't hang out with just because you have your own clique or you're too busy with your normal circle of friends. But that dialogue helps with understanding other people and increases knowledge. Then later on, increases, you know, that sense of inclusivity and understanding between people of different backgrounds. So my thought process is start at the person level. What can the person do to change that dynamic? And what can we teach our kids in the future of how to continue to change that dynamic in the world we live in?
Oh, and I couldn't agree with you more. And to that point, I mean, that's very similar to what I said about the transgendered movement in your last show, right? The more access we have, the more conversations we have, the more open-minded we become. And at the end of the day, their acceptance will become at some point inevitable. And humanity in its course of history does not change overnight. That has never been the case. As a historian, I can tell you that when you change things too quickly, it turns not so good. It turns actually pretty bad for everybody. And that being said, let's move on to the next discussion as to, and I just want to go back to what the panelists said, because I think it's important we go back to that. And unfortunately for you, which makes me all the happier, I know you. And we both went to public schools for most of our lives. We didn't get a private education till we went to college. And one of your panelists said that she attended an elite private school in Manhattan for high school. Yes, she was insulted. And I remember you being insulted. I remember me being constantly insulted, or what have you. So all due respect to her, everyone is insulted in high school one way or the other. And by the way, newsflash, kids are cruel. I mean, is that like a main thing? I understand that what they said was grotesquely racist and it was completely unwarranted, but I can admit to you right now that for most of my public educational life, especially when I was in middle school, I was beat up by the very people that she claims to be for. I was beat up by my other minorities and my viewpoint, but I don't castigate them and cause them to you know, you guys are evil, so I'm not going to let you do anything. No, I didn't go that route. So my question is, what is privilege? And do we have it, or does she have it, or what? Where's this privilege nonsense coming from?
Here's the problem. The way they mean it, it's that because our skin is lighter, we're of a lighter complexion, we have had certain things in their mind handed to us, or we've gotten a pass on certain things, or have gotten opportunities that maybe people with darker complexions have been passed on because people have made assumptions about them. That's how they mean it. The problem is, when I first heard that, and this is this goes back to the concept that has been very popular recently, which is the concept of white privilege. I don't come from a rich family. My parents were blue collar immigrants to the United States. Everything that they have and everything that I have, I've had to work tooth and nail for. So when somebody makes an assumption about me because based on the color of my skin that I've had it easier than them, I think that that is committing the same atrocity that they commit, that they allege other people commit when they look at them and make assumptions about their character based on their color of their skin.
I'm sorry, I just want to ask one, and to where you're going to, are you saying it's a hypocritical self-eating argument?
Yeah, because at that point you're saying you had it easy because you're white, or in my case, I'm passing because I'm Hispanic. You have it easy because you look white. That negates all the troubles that I've had in my life, all the troubles that my family has had, just because you look at me and assume that I've essentially lived in a mansion since I was a little girl and have gone to private schools and have had no money issues and haven't had to work for anything in my life, which is the opposite of my life. I've had to work for every single success that I've ever had, and nobody has given me anything. Now, what I will concede is that maybe I've had certain advantages. coming from a family that, you know, gave me good values, that taught me that education is important and that working hard is important. Maybe those are advantages I can admit to. But telling me that I have privilege because of the color of my skin is as insulting as you saying that it's something derogatory about Black Americans because of the color of their skin.
So then that begs the next question. Do Black lives matter?
Black lives matter. Cuban lives matter. Police officers' lives matter. Every life matters. With that said, I think that we can still have a discussion about how certain communities are affected by certain institutions. So police brutality, how does it affect not just the Black community, but the white community, the Hispanic community? I think those are worthwhile conversations. But I would like to see a conversation more about, why can't police brutality be a race-neutral issue? Why is it automatically the police officers are racist? And that's always something that astounds me. The assumption cannot always be that if a police officer behaves inappropriately and police brutality occurs, the assumption cannot be that he's a racist if it involves a black individual. That cannot be the assumption, because also whites are on the receiving end of police brutality. Hispanics are on the receiving end. So there's something more to there than race. And ignoring that is just disingenuous.
Okay, so if that were the case, and I can't speak to Minnesota, I can't speak to Michigan, I can't speak to New York, but I can certainly speak to South Florida. Do you feel like your own South Florida police, whether it be Miami-Dade Police Department or the Miami Police Department or the Hialeah Police Department, for all the listeners that don't know much about Florida, let me tell you, we are a megalopolis. It's very similar to New York, but instead of boroughs, we actually have cities that control us. So in my perspective, do any of these micro cities that surround the greater Miami area, and indeed the county police, do you ever feel that they are racist or violent towards you at any moment in time?
I'll be honest, I have the best opinion of our local law enforcement, but I know that not everybody can say the same about their local departments. So I feel that here in South Florida, especially, I think we have good training programs. We train our police officers in de-escalation strategies. I think that that needs to be happening across the country, because police officers are asked to do so much, not only law enforcement, but they have to be essentially social workers and therapists and do so many things, that so much pressure is put on them as individuals to perform at a certain level. And maybe we are putting too much on their plate. Maybe that needs to be more of the discussion. Just let them be law enforcement. Maybe we need to reallocate duties to other departments and agencies. But here in South Florida, I think we have it figured out. I think we know how to do police work the right way. And shout out to Miami PD. You guys are awesome. And shout out to my cousin Alex, who's part of the force and serves our community. So I am grateful for the good police officers out there. Those brave people that put their lives on the line every day. Are there bad cops? Sure. There's also bad lawyers and bad doctors. All of those are bad equally.
And I think that people have forgotten that, you know, during this entire situation of quarantine and pandemic mayhem, it's the police that's really done a lot of the workload as far as not only being the first responders to a lot of people who are sick. They are the first to be called to, you know, actually bring tests to local people to make sure that they're okay and they're safe and they're healthy. So into that respect, we all need to take a step back and realize that, for the most part, police are the first responders. That's the first in line before the medics, before the craziness of the fire department. It's always the police that arrives first, and I think that people forget that. So, in kudos to them, because as far as that's concerned, I hope to God every day that they're patrolling my neighborhoods. I want them. I welcome them in my neighborhoods. I have no fear of them at all. I think that their presence is a mediating factor and calms a lot of nerves, because then people know that either have to relax themselves and understand that there's other people around and you're going to have to respect that, or B, it also relieves the stress and the worry from certain citizens like myself who would like to know that there is some peace and quiet out there instead of the mayhem that's going on right now.
So here's the thing, though. As much as police officers should be respected and appreciated, I also think that this conversation also brings into, you know, into debate, you know, our Second Amendment rights. And if you do believe that the police are not doing the correct job as far as taking care of your communities, well, then these states where, you know, liberals are in control and heavily regulate our Second Amendment rights, what's wrong? You know, we need to evaluate that as well. If you think police can't do it, but you live in a state that doesn't allow you to exercise those Second Amendment rights, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you just going to cry for help if someone is trying to break into your house? Can't call police, can't use your Second Amendment right? What are you going to do? So it actually brings other discussions into the fold that I think we're ignoring. I mean, your right to self-defense as an individual, that is something that you should have regardless. And in some of these states that have also these problematic police departments, you don't have Second Amendment rights.
Well, and on top of that, you're now seeing, and by the way, just for everyone to understand, if our side took over six city blocks of a major city, like what's going on in Seattle, they would come in with guns a-blazing to get us out of that area. So I think it's hilarious that you have six city blocks within Seattle that are controlled by basically what I call the mob, because at the end of the day, when you take physical control of a city and you are basically the only ones that have firearms and you are now hankering local businesses for money so you can run said little district, you have basically become a mob. And this same mob is now taking down statues all over the country. And you know how much history means to me. And yes, the Confederate General Robert E. Lee is one of my heroes in history. Just for your listeners to understand, before I go my tirade, he wasn't a diehard Confederate person. He went to West Point with all the other major generals of his time, and he said very plainly, "If Virginia votes for the Union, I'll fight for the Union. If Virginia votes for the Confederacy, I will fight for the Confederacy." And slavery wasn't the main point for him. It was his citizenship to his own residence. It was his citizenship to his own state. There's a big difference, right? Before all this, the United States were not the states had much more power and were the overwhelming governance, and the federal government had very limited power. The day and age that we live in now, it's kind of a little bit of the opposite. So if we take that into consideration, we have to also realize the very history in which it stands on. And by the way, another little tidbit of history, Robert E. Lee's very own plantation after the war was used to create the most sacred land in American history. It is called Arlington Cemetery, where all of our heroes are buried. That's Lee's plantation, or was at least. Something that people also don't understand is the fact that he built a university after the Civil War, and he didn't have rights to vote at all until the very later stages of his life. He sacrificed a lot to get back into the Union and to get back to regular life. So when I see a statue or monument or anything named after him, I don't see slavery as an institution. I see states' rights. I see a man of honor. I see my hero. And recently I was told that I was privileged to see him in this way. Do you think I'm privileged to see him in this way? As a Hispanic 29-year-old, am I privileged to understand him this way?
I think that you're educated. That's why you understand him in this way. I think that's key here, right? Understanding your history, understanding the events that lead up to our current dilemmas. So the fact that you are able to look at a Robert E. Lee statue and say, okay, yes, slavery was a component here in his era, but he also stood up for so much more. And maybe the slavery issue in his agenda was a tertiary issue. And he was more concerned about Virginia's rights and the rights of his fellow Virginians and the power the federal government had over the states. That was the main thing on his agenda. The fact that you understand that makes you highly educated, highly sophisticated. And not many people know that. They get dragged by the mob into believing that everybody who fought for the Confederacy was a diehard racist And we ignore the realities of the time they were living in, and we ignore the complexity of the Civil War, which was more than just racism and slavery. There were other things going on as well.
And I just want to add one last question to this entire monuments issue, because I also think, like, for example, and it goes way beyond Confederate generals. They're actually going after, and for anyone who does not know this, the mob has defiled the Lincoln Memorial, try to take down the Andrew Jackson Memorial in Washington, D.C., and even, yes, even Grant, General Grant and President Grant, the very person who actually not only fought for the Civil War, but also fought after the Civil War to stop any kind of Jim Crow slash white power movements that were going on in the South way after the fact that he was a general and during his presidency. So let's just be very clear here, right? They're not just going after what people would consider controversial figures. Now they're going after established, understood people. Even Thomas Jefferson is being defiled. The very person who wrote the exact words, "We find these truths to be self-evident that every man is created equal." That man is now being castigated. And by the way, if he's a racist, guess what? We would have to erase our entire 200 years of history if that's the case. Because guess what? Racism existed. Yes, it did. And it was codified racism, because that was not racism at the time. It was understood as general codified culture at the time. And unfortunately, that, and I'm sad to say that, right? I'm not saying that was a happy situation. I'm the first to tell you, I absolutely agree. It was very sad that we weren't there yet, but progress isn't made overnight. Rome was not built overnight. Rome is built through blood, toil, tears, and sweat, and only through which we can celebrate the benefits of that society by actually understanding the tumultuous war front that we had to go to get there. You cannot, there has to be a starting point. There has to be a fight. There has to be conflict. That is how progress is made. So my question is that even if we take that away, let's just go to the very fact that you want to take away this monument. If in fact monuments and historical figures adds insult to injury, should it be through a legislative process or a governor-issued order to take a monument down? Or should we be allowing the mob to determine what stays and what?
So here's the problem. If you tell me I want society to be educated about the history of these monuments, about the men that they lionize, I'm all for that. You know, you need to take the good with the bad. You need to understand what they did, the achievements that they are known for today, and also the negative side to their history, because everybody that is lionized in those statues is a person who is imperfect. So here's the problem. If you tell me we need to know the history, I'm all for it. But when you start tearing down monuments, you want something else. It's not societal change you're looking for. Because you know this very well, Carlos. The only ones who topple statues, the only ones that topple monuments and desecrate them are people that want a change of government, a revolution, a complete change of the status quo. And we need to understand our past. We need to learn from it. But we cannot reject it in that way, because at that point, you are looking for something else. You are looking to change the fundamentals. And I'm not looking to change the fundamentals of America. I love America. Can we do better? Absolutely. But to your question about who should handle or decide what happens to those statues, let the governments, the local state governments and the federal governments, decide if they want those statues removed. You as an individual desecrating a statue will only feed the narrative that your movement is not guided by the right principles, because destruction is never going to lead to more understanding.
And I couldn't full-heartedly agree with you more. I mean, if you look at the history as far as, and not just monuments, I mean, you just have to take the holistic perspective And what I fear, actually, and I think, and what does that mean? That means that this is for your listeners to understand, a Jacobian revolution as opposed to a Soviet revolution. A Jacobian revolution is not coming from a place where they're communists. It's a place where they just want to dismantle history without having any substitute for it. So what they're trying to do is they're literally destroying without understanding. They're destroying without actually replacing. They're not allowing society or the people to make the determinations for themselves. And by doing so, they're trying to change society overnight. And that leads to what we understand as Jacobian threat, which basically means the guillotine years. Because at some point, there's going to be a backlash, and the backlash for them is not going to be pretty. And therefore, they will react more extremely. And the more we react and act or extremely, the more it becomes more hostilic. It becomes nasty. It becomes horrible.
So here's the problem, Carlos. These statues have nothing to do with what happened to Mr. Floyd.
Nothing.
This is just a left-wing agenda trying to rewrite our history. And we get it. You don't like Thomas Jefferson. You don't like George Washington. You don't like the founders of this country. You can keep Christopher Columbus. I don't care about him very much. But
not fair to the Italians in New York City that defended him.
He wasn't a person. You can keep Christopher Columbus. I'll take my Jeffersons. I'll take my Washingtons. I'll even take my Lees. They're complex characters.
Oh, this is where I want the president to come in and say, I love the Italians. The Italian community is phenomenal. We love you. And thank you for protecting your beautiful Christopher Columbus statue.
But going back to what you were discussing, it has nothing to do with these statues. Now, what I do find interesting is that the statues that are being taken down, it's not every figure that's immortalized that has a statue that's being targeted. It's only the white ones that are being targeted. So, again, we're now seeing the opposite happen. Before, we saw society target people of a certain race because of their race. Now the backlash to that is we're going to target white same way, or the perceived the same way that blacks were targeted in the past. Two wrongs don't make a right. You cannot negate what those men did, the achievements they were able to contribute to society. And by the same token, you cannot negate the evil that some of them did.
No,
you learn from both.
I absolutely agree. But at the same, and I just want to add this caveat, nowhere am I saying that there should not be a memorial for Martin Luther King Jr. You want a memorial? Build one. I will visit it. I will go to Martin Luther King's memorial and bless it. I'm happy to go. I'm happy to go to a memorial for Rosetta Scott King. I'm happy to go see a Booker T. Washington memorial. Where are those? Why aren't those more prominent? Well, I'm sorry. If you really want change, if you really want to make that difference, then don't destroy, create.
It's easier to destroy than to create.
Well, it's always easier, but that's not how you build a society.
No, but I don't think they're trying to build a society. I think they're trying to dismantle one that some believe has been unfair to them.
In that respect, I'll take the conservative route. You are only going to be respected, or you're only going to be able to give what you give in life. So if you feel that there's too many white memorials, the answer is you don't destroy it. You build more black memorials. That's the answer. But if that is your concern, then build them. Build them and build them big, tall, build them proud, build them as much as you'd like, as long as within the confines of your local understanding of society. If it's, you have to go through a legislative process, you have to go through that, all those things, because guess how those monuments were made? They weren't made because some artist decided to say, oh, I just want to build this Robert E. Lee statue right over here. It was donated.
Yeah, and there's some legal issues attached to some of these statues they're desecrating.
Oh, absolutely. I love that.
It's not as easy as, oh, I desecrated a statue, big whoop. Some of these belong to the federal government. Some people could be facing up to 10 years in prison for desecrating them. And some of these are private property on loan to local governments.
Yeah.
People don't know that.
Well, on top, yeah, Virginia had to literally stop the taking down of the Robert E. Lee, General Robert E. Lee statue, because it wasn't the government's to take down, and nor was it the federal, local government to decide to take it down, because it has a contract of over 110 years to maintain and to be stood up. So I mean, seriously, if we're going to say that we hate these things and we want to change these things, then do it within the means that you have to change them.
But again, it's easier to destroy than create.
That's true. So with all this being said, and I know we've gone through a lot, and I know we discussed a lot of details and probably more than what your panelists said, but on top of that, my final question to you is, do you think the conversation you had with the panel benefited you in any way, or do you wish you hadn't done the interview to begin with? And I want to put a very big caveat to this. I know you didn't publish the last part of the three-part series, and I want you to explain why you didn't, and I want to know why that decision placates to these other two questions and how you end.
I decided not to do it because I thought that the conversation wasn't really bringing anything of note to the podcast listenership. Specifically, I did not think that it was a dialogue. Conversations on that podcast were at times one-sided, and admittedly, I allowed it to be so because I was trying to be overly inclusive to the panel. But it came to a point, especially with the content of the last episode, that some of the stuff that were said there made me uncomfortable to put on my platform. So I made the edit, using my editorial discretion, not to air the third episode, because I wasn't going to put out there information, opinions that did not reflect the brand that is Right Owl Politics. Now, to your first question, do I regret
doing you had that? Do you wish you had, or do you wish you hadn't done the interview to begin with?
Well, here's the thing. I'm happy I did, because I always feel, let me put it this way, I feel that more conversation is better than less, and understanding other people's points of view can enlighten your point of view to a certain extent. So I don't regret doing it. I do think, though, that race relations in this country are not in a place that we can say it is a better place than it was before this tragedy. I actually think that it's worse. And I think that as a society, we need to look at these very complex issues and objectively say, you know, people are allowed to interpret things differently. We cannot just all jump and say it's racism. Sometimes bad things happen, and it's not because a person is a racist, just because that person is a bad person. And you cannot accuse a person of being a racist just because of the way they look. And I say this with all due respect to everybody on that panel, and I respect them for coming on the show, but we need to be very careful in how we discuss these issues, that we do not just catalog everybody who has a pale complexion as a racist, or expect them to feel guilt for the misdeeds of past generations, because that's not fair. So I think the biggest learning I had from that podcast is listening to people requires a lot of, security of mind. And also, I think it's important to emphasize that sometimes when you say a dialogue, it means different things to different people. My understanding of a dialogue is that both sides get to speak. Some people in this context believe that a dialogue just that you hear out the people that feel aggrieved. So it's difficult navigating these waters. It's difficult for a podcaster, anybody in the media, anybody who's a professional trying to navigate these very toxic waters we're in right now. But here's the thing. I love my country. I believe that racism is evil. I want to extinguish it. At the same time, I also want to improve our police departments across the country so that we have lower percentages of police brutality towards all races. And I hope that someday soon we can actually make Dr. King's dream of true equality a reality. But right now, race relations in this country are worse off than they were a month ago.
Well, and I also want to point out that, and I think there's a great analogy to what you just said. You were expecting a tennis court match where one person has the ball and then is tossed to the other to create what is considered a dialogue of ideas. Instead, you got a cannonball and you brought a musket to a cannonball fight.
And that was my mistake because I was going at it from what I like to call the Oprah Winfrey approach, right? You sit down with somebody, have a conversation, maybe you can move hearts and change minds. But if not everybody has the same agenda or not everybody's on the same page with that, then the conversation becomes toxic and not as productive very quickly.
Do you feel, and I always felt that racist is such a, it's almost an immediate no talk conversation. It's like, once you are determined a racist, and this goes true now more so than ever, you lose everything. Not only do you lose the debate, you now lose your job, you lose your contracts, you lose everything that made you who you are because someone perceived you this way or called you this way. And if you have enough people to agree to that, now we're seeing it's I think it's often too easy to call someone racist. I think people don't realize the repercussion of what it actually involves in calling someone a racist, and it's sad.
Oh, absolutely. And right now, even somebody being accused of racism is enough to destroy that person's whole reality, from losing their job to losing business connections. Just being accused of it is enough. You don't even have to show that it's true. Just being accused of it is enough. There's a presumption of guilt, especially if you are of a lighter complexion. So that's a dangerous precedent, because if we are not comfortable enough to have these difficult discussions, then there's not going to be movement on this issue, because you know what people are going to do? They're going to ignore the issue. They're going to avoid talking about it. Or they're just going to tell people what they believe those people want to hear. And it's going to be disingenuous, and it's not going to move the conversation forward. So my hope is that sometime in our lifetime, we can actually reach a point where we can discuss these issues. And it's not about blame. It's about healing. It's about moving forward. It's about fixing the problems that exist in our society and not fixating on a past that cannot be changed and expecting society to make amends for things that are not in our control to fix because they happened before our present time. Unless we acknowledge that that is the terms of the conversation, we're never going to move forward because we're stuck in a 400-year loop that goes over and over again the same topics.
And just one last thing, only because I heard this and I thought it was the best motto I have ever heard. And progress or success, no matter how you look at it, it's not a straight line. It's a zigzag. It's a zigzag. And it's not an easy road for progress. It's not an easy road for the future. That's not how life exists.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because absolutely it is a zigzag. But you can self-sabotage any success you have by the actions you take. And I think that some, not all, because saying that all of them, all the people that are demanding social justice and social change have bad intentions, that would be disingenuous on my part. But there are some that are not doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it to win political points and to advance agendas that are actually not about social justice. It's about political objectives.
Yeah, I didn't know communism was considered a social justice.
Right. Because spray painting communist symbols on statues of our founding fathers and others is really the point of these protests, right? I missed that part. That was sarcasm on my part. but it's sad, because you would think in the year 2020 we would have progressed enough that we can have these discussions in a respectful manner. But we haven't. And it's hard, because is it worth having these discussions? I'll tell you this. I'll share this with you. When I was editing that series, and I'm in my studio at home editing, it stressed me out, because...
Oh, I can only imagine. I even told you that this was going to be maddening to do.
And here's the thing. It's not because the comments made me uncomfortable. It's just because of the premise. And there was something about listening to that and saying, you know, I don't know if this is helping the conversation. Am I just stirring the pot more? And for those of you out there that are like, oh, well, Ariana, I'm sure you got a lot of listeners out of that show. Actually, those two episodes were the most unpopular programs on our podcast to this date. Because just how uncomfortable it made me feel, it probably made other listeners as well. Because it wasn't a dialogue. It was a little bit too heated at times. So I'm glad I did it. I did my part. You know, I tried to lead by example. And I thought that I could help the conversation. But I unfortunately realized that America right now is too immature to have this conversation.
And with that being said, I couldn't.
Thanks for coming on the show and interviewing me, Carlos. It was
no, thank
different.
You.
It's different being the interviewee. Different.
Well, it's good. It's, sometimes you need to be the interviewee. Sometimes they need to hear from you.
Yes, this is true. Well, thank you again, Carlos.
Absolutely. All righty.
Thanks again, Carlos, for coming on the show and interviewing me. It was a lot of fun. And really, I feel much better now that I was able to discuss my take on that series, Let's Get Uncomfortable. And honestly, lots of love to everybody who participated on that panel. I just think that's a great example of how we as a country have a lot more healing to do. And in order to move forward on the topic, I think we need more dialogue, more specific, concrete steps to rectify these issues that plague our society. So I'm sending a virtual hug to everybody listening to now. We can do it, guys. We're Americans. We've been through a lot of very difficult situations in our history. And this is another chapter. This is another challenge that we can turn the page on and tackle. So, guys, remember, we're available on social media at Right Owl Politics on Instagram. Like, share, and subscribe. All new content, all new updates on our show will be available on that page. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, we're not your dad's political news show, so spread the word. Bye, guys.